And welcome to the latest in Innovation Forum's webinar series with me, Ian Welsh. Today, we're going to debate how companies can accelerate action to remove tropical deforestation from their supply chains. Many companies, large and small, have made commitments to eliminate deforestation from their supply chains by 2020. But writing a policy doesn't stop deforestation, acting on the commitment does. And now, with only two more years to deliver on 2020 targets, the pressing question is, will this happen? There is a clear need to accelerate action with more joined-up thinking to develop properly deforestation-free supply chains. And to help address this need, Climate Focus, along with TFA 2020, has prepared a new report, Commodity and Forest Agenda 2020, 10 Priorities to Remove Tropical Deforestation from Supply Chains. This is designed to serve as a framework for action at the global and regional level in order to accelerate progress in addressing deforestation. You will have received a link to the report earlier today, and you may find it useful to have it to hand during our discussion. To lead the debate over the next hour, we have an expert panel. We have Marco Albani, Director of Tropical Forest Trust, Tropical Forest Alliance, rather, 2020. Isabella Vitale, Latin America Co-Director with ProForest. Stephen Donofrio, Senior Advisor with Supply Change. And Sa David Jr., National Red Plus Coordinator, the Forest Development Authority of the Republic of Liberia. Sa, unfortunately, isn't able to join us right now. We're hoping that he'll join us during the course of our hour. My thanks to our co-hosts, TFA 2020, and to my Innovation Forum colleague, Charlene Ordonez, for convening our panel and organising this webinar today. And the issues we're covering will be discussed further at Innovation Forum's upcoming conference in partnership with TFA 2020 on how business can tackle deforestation, which will be held in Jakarta next month, 17th and 18th of October. And also, we'll be meeting in London on the 14th and 15th of November. Full details are on Innovation Forum's website, where you can sign up for best price passes, and I hope to see you at one of these meetings. Back to today. I will shortly invite our panelists to make some opening remarks to kick things off. We will have some follow-up discussion, and I will then open the debate up to audience questions, particularly during the second half of our hour. We do want to be as interactive as possible today, so please do submit your questions using the comments box on the webinar dashboard, and I will put them to our panel. Questions can be directed to all the panel or to one panelist in particular. And if you can keep your questions short, it is more likely that I will use them. Please also note that, as usual for Innovation Forum, there will be no slides, and this is a structured panel discussion throughout. So, turning to our panel, Marco, perhaps you can go first. And give us an overview of the reasoning behind the new report and also what you're setting out to achieve. Marco.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you so much. And thanks, everybody, for joining this discussion. The report comes out of the assessment that was carried out by the group that does the New York Declaration on Forest Assessment every year. Last year, we partnered with them to do a deep dive on Goal 2 of the New York Declaration on Forest, which is the elimination of deforestation caused by agricultural commodities and traded commodities by the year 2020. And this report is available on the forestdeclaration.org as well as on our TFA2020.org website. And at the time, it was clear the report came out about a year ago now, a little bit less, but around the Conference of the Parties in Marrakesh. And it was clear that the pace at which change is happening when we look at commodity-driven deforestation is actually not making us confident that we'll actually meet this 2020 goal, to say the least. And actually, I would say that probably makes us actually quite pessimistic about the ability to meet this goal if we don't accelerate action. And out of that came a request from our constituents that, you know, if you're familiar with Tropical Forest Alliance, this is actually a collaboration platform. It's not an NGO, it's a platform that is set up to create opportunities for collaboration between business, civil society, and government on eliminating deforestation from commodity supply chains. And so we heard from the over 100 partners that we have now on the platform that there was a need to develop a view or a vision of what is needed to accelerate pace and to move as fast as we can and get as far as we can against this 2020 deadline. And that kicked off an exercise where we basically went through a extensive consultation carry out starting in December of last year, and we had the first in-person meeting with experts as well as stakeholders from, again, business, government, civil society, indigenous people representative, and took it in a first version of this idea to our General Assembly in Brasilia that was held in March last year, where we had again a pretty extensive discussion on what were some of the emerging priorities. And the objective was, if we need to push this agenda, and we do need to push this agenda because we know that really that the clock is ticking on climate, is ticking on species losses, is ticking on biodiversity, is ticking on livelihoods, it's ticking on many of the things that we're trying to solve. And so what are the most important things that, that we need to work on? What is going to push us as far as we can between now and 2020 and make us get there, if we're not by 2020, then as soon as we can after? And this agenda emerged. We took all this input, which was largely based on discussions and expert opinion, and commissioned this work to Climate Focus, which is a consultant with a lot of experience in this space, to actually go back and try to do some of the analytics behind the reasoning that the experts were giving. And sometimes experts can be a bit of an echo chamber. And so the idea was to pressure test with some analytics some of the statements and the ideas that were coming out. And then went back in another round of consultation. So this version then was, so the first long round of consultations, then analytics, then back consultation with stakeholders. And we held consultations in Jakarta, in Ghana, in Sao Paulo, with the partners of TFA, and then we published now the report as it is. And I don't know if we're going to go in, want me to go into the 10 priorities, but I think before we go into the list, I think it's important to recognize that this list is not a list in order of importance. All the 10 priorities are actually important. They're not necessarily equally important to everyone. There are differences between regions and between supply chains, exposure, and so on, but they're all important. And so the order shouldn't be seen as an order of importance. And it should not be seen as sequential. These are all things that we need to push at the same time. So it's not like we do number one and then we do number two and then we do number three. So this is a menu. It's a, that I think is designed to be read by senior decision makers to check their strategies. If they're trying to get rid of deforestation in supply chains, whether they're government officials, ministers of agriculture, minister of forestry in the tropical forest countries, or ministers of trade in a buyer country, or their CEOs of companies that have exposure to these commodities and made commitments, or their NGO leaders, then this should be helpful to say, am I doing things against all 10 of this, right? And if not, why not, right? And if I am actually doing stuff that is not in this list of 10, do I have a really good reason to keep doing it? And there might be, right? Every organization will have a different angle of attack to this problem and will have a different contribution they can make. So this is not to say that everybody needs to work on everything that it's on this list, that the things that are not on this list are not valuable. But these are the ones that came out as the most important and the ones that can push us the farthest in this immediate deadline of getting to 2020, which is really only 2.5 years away. Then there's clearly a need to create a new regenerative economy for the world that I think the climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis and the wildlife crisis is bringing to us. This is, to some extent, is the longer 2030 agenda of the Sustainable Development Goals. And so there are things that are not in this list that are very important for that 2030 agenda, but on which we have probably a little bit more of time. But this is the most urgent stuff.
Thank you very much, Marco. Just to remind everybody, if you click on the link that we sent you earlier today, you can pull the report up. And there's a very handy executive summary, which does have the 10 points outlined. We are going to go through them all now with the rest of the panel. I've asked them to pick out in particular some of the report's 10 agenda points that they feel are most interesting and relevant for them. So Isabella from ProForest, turning to you, with a focus on Brazil, perhaps you can highlight relevant issues around point one on the list, which is eliminating illegality from supply chains. Point three, skilling up pilot programs around sustainable beef. And point five, achieving sustainable soy production. Isabella, over to you.
Hi, thank you, Ian. Yes, I think one of the biggest merits of this top 10 priorities is that they recognize that there are different types of deforestation that will require different types of interventions. So it's completely different when we're talking about concessions, large private holdings, small holdings, areas where people have no rights to the land or where the deforestation is happening illegally. So on this last topic, you're asking me to comment on eliminating illegality from supply chain. It is impressive to realize that about half of the tropical deforestation is illegal. And that usually happens because, you know, either because there's low law enforcement and then there's no motivation for the producers to follow the law, or sometimes they're just ignorant about it. They don't know what they're supposed to be doing, or that there are limits to what they could be deforesting. And also what sometimes happens is that you have conflicting land rights. So communities and producers overlapping the same area. One of the biggest interventions that has been, it's not very fashionable these days, but it does do the job, is providing communities with recognized land title to their areas. So in Brazil, if you see the indigenous lands, deforestation rates and the area around them, the difference is starking. But again, it doesn't mean that's not going to work everywhere, but there is an opportunity in several places around the world where communities still don't have recognized rights to their lands. And this is relatively low cost intervention that the government can do. And what it does effectively is take land out of the speculation market by putting it firmly in the hands of some of these traditional communities. But apart from that, when you have a situation where it is fragmented areas, there is some production, some forest standing, and there's low law enforcement, producers don't have an incentive not to deforest. On the contrary, they have all incentives to deforest. Adding a little bit of buyer influence is sometimes what it's needed to start on the path of legal enforcement. And I think in Brazil, there are some good examples of that. Even the public prosecutor started going after companies that buy from farms that produce cattle in illegally deforested areas and make the companies, the buyers, responsible for that deforestation, not just the producer. And with that, they've pretty much set in motion a lot of measures that have increased transparency in the supply chain, have increased governance, and created the motivation for suppliers to start complying with the law. In a wider context, if you look at the EU Timber Regulation and the Lacey Act in the US, they also follow the same logic. It is public policy, building on the power of the market to try and enforce legality within the supply chains. So that can take us a long way. No one can really refuse to follow the law. And that's different from several of the other interventions that we have here in this list. The level of resistance to this agenda is much lower. And that also provides local ownership of the agenda. In the long run, it can provide better governance, increase the rule of law, and these are all things that are conducive to business. So all in all, eliminating illegality from supply chains is definitely one of the interventions with highest impact that we can do. And there is a role for government, a role for companies, and there is a role for NGOs as well in supporting that process, providing information, etc. Quickly moving on to the other.
Isabella, are you there? We've lost Isabella just now. Isabella, can you hear me? Isabella, are you back?
Needed.
Isabella, fine. Can you?
Oh, all right. I'm not sure how long I was gone.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. The wonders of technology. Isabella, if you perhaps could, you'd finished giving your thoughts around eliminating illegality and you're moving on to scaling up pilot programs. Could you perhaps give us your thoughts on that, please?
So, rewinding. Scaling up pilot programs on sustainable intensification of cattle grazing, it is all about saving land so that other crops can increase their area and their production without having to deforest. And this can be done because cattle is the commodity with the largest footprint at the moment, larger than all the other commodities with forest risk combined. And it doesn't need all that land. The current production system, most common in South America, requires very little input. It has hardly any pasture management. So with a little bit of good practices, like things like rotating the pasture, investing in managing that pasture, you can actually increase the productivity of the current land enormously and stop the cycle of having to move ahead because the pasture has been degraded and you still need more area. But the good thing is that, you know, cattle intensification in this sense, sustainable cattle intensification, not talking necessarily here about confinement, it makes business sense and it is happening. It is more profitable than the current practices and producers are starting to realize it. And it's a normal process. It's going to happen somehow. So the question really is about how to speed this process up and also how to ensure that it does not lead to more deforestation. Because if it increases profitability, if you don't put the right measures in place, it could also increase deforestation because it becomes a more profitable activity. Therefore, why not increase the area and earn even more money from it? So there are a few things that need to be in place for that to happen. In terms of speeding up the process, it is about companies including this element of sustainable intensification in their supply engagement programs. It's also about embedding it in public policy, particularly public credit. And it's also about increasing the level of technical assistance available for producers to be able to buy into these new technologies that allow.
Isabella, we appear to have lost you again. Apologies, everybody. Does appear we have lost Isabella. Right, okay, I will turn to Stephen now. Stephen, perhaps you can just outline your comments around strengthening palm oil certification, which is point two of the agenda, point six, accelerating implementation of jurisdictional programs, and also point 10.
Quite a lot of support to do that.
Improving the quality of data. Stephen, over to you.
Great. Ian, you can hear me okay?
Absolutely. Thanks, Stephen.
All right. well, thanks very much for pulling me into this webinar. It's great to be joining you guys today. And we just had a successful Climate Week event yesterday. So I think we're all a bit tired from that. But I'll do my best to be coherent and happy to answer any questions you have as follow-up. The role of supply chains is to look at what's happening as a whole across companies and commitments related to the four key commodities of palm oil, soy, cattle, and pulp and timber. And, you know, it's a little bit more broad than just, are they committing to zero deforestation? You know, we do try to have an understanding of the bigger picture, and that does relate to things that have already been discussed, like yields, improvement, but you know, something like specifically for cattle, for example, might be around animal welfare. So these are not just metrics or data points specifically looking at what is the environmental impact or what are the potential benefits of establishing a sustainable or responsible production or sourcing policy, and going on with that is certification. The reality is there are many different ways companies can commit to greening, effectively their commodity supply or production. And when companies are establishing these goals, particularly when it comes to palm oil and other commodities where there are established and well-defined certification schemes, that's where we're finding companies really leaning on being public-facing as a goal of what their commitments are. So we've seen over the past few years of our work that certification, and especially from 2016, from 2017, that certification has had the most most progress reported and increase in progress reported over all other commitments. And we feel that this has a lot to do with the numeric and actual quantifiable nature of volumes related to certification. But it does beg the question of if all companies establish certification goals and we had all these companies that are demanding a supply of commodity, is there enough demand to fill that? And as all commodity markets that are supply and demand driven with price, how does that actually work fundamentally? And so we don't necessarily have the answers to those questions, but this increase of interest and of public facing goal setting that's related to certification, particularly in palm oil, which we have found the growth of progress reporting from palm oil is about 75% from 2016 to 2017. So, there's across the board certification is seeing growth and companies being very transparent about their progress of achieving a sustainable supply. And so that's very encouraging, but at the same time, we also have to ask the question, is there enough supply out there to meet that demand? And how do we work, in those jurisdictions, in those landscapes, as a global community to provide that supply to the market that's increasingly demanding it. And that does lead me into just some comments about, jurisdictional programs and, while we don't necessarily get too embedded in any specific approaches, or we don't make any recommendations and such like TFA has done in this document, again, if we can serve as a sort of a data collections input into informing these recommendations or informing the outcomes of these recommendations, I'm very interested in doing that. And we've looked at whether or not we're able to track company commitments and policies on a geographic level and how that could be of benefit to governments and jurisdictional programs on establishing policies or programs. And I guess this is also connected to the final point around 10, which is availability of deforestation and supply chain data, because if we want to have that type of information, we're just not finding enough availability of geographic reference points from company commitment data to lead us there. And so it would almost be a call to companies to define their commitments more in a geographic scope and allow us to be able to track that and any of the reporting that they do. And as many of you may know already, that we do not depend on just one data source, nor do we have companies report into supply chain. But we look at a variety of data sources. CDP is one of them, but we also have many others that we pull in here. So for us, it's not necessarily, we're not trying to be prescriptive, but if we wanted to get to that level of detail, we would need to see more transparency and reporting from the companies on that. And I guess I'll just wrap it up by saying that as we are, effectively looking at already reported data from companies, we do encourage, standardization and, a very consistent timeline of reporting and transparency to provide updates to the global network of stakeholders about where companies are on achieving their commitments. but it's inconsistent, as we all you know, can see. It's we see companies reporting in different platforms, whether it's through certification programs or it's their website, sustainability report, CDP, and other places. And that's in many ways okay with us, because we're happy to pull in the different sources and compile the information. But what it raises is a point around you know, what is the need for better consistency? And we all agree that it's consistency both in terms of the platforms that are used to report, but also consistency in the metrics that are being desired from these companies. And those metrics and data points are different depending on the stakeholder that we're talking about. And so investors may have certain interests versus civil society versus government. And so we're converging, I think, at this point in time to better understanding that need and better understanding how to get there. And that's where, you know, collaborations come in, you know, such as what Supply Chain is just established with the accountability framework, and others, to see how we can inform the development of these frameworks. There's also a point to be made about the rise of tools and platforms that are monitoring what's actually happening on the ground through geospatial technologies, or looking at flows of commodities from production to sourcing locations. And as that continues to develop and become more sophisticated and more exact, it will bring a call to companies to say that, hey, what you're reporting and what you're being transparent about needs to have alignment with what we're seeing on the ground. And you know, the more that companies can help help stakeholders see the connection between what they're reporting and what these tools are providing, that's I think where supply chain will have a strong function continuing to go forward in providing that consolidation and aggregation of company reported information, to be able to pair it up with the other tools and information that we're seeing emerging from these different platforms. So I'm very excited and interested and encouraged to see that this report has been released and these recommendations are available. There's a lot of different initiatives and programs and organizations working on all of these different pieces, but obviously much more work has to be done. And so, very interested to see how supply chain and forest trends can be a part of that going forward.
Thanks, Stephen.
So I'll leave it there and go ahead.
Thank you. Just a very quick question. Can you just clarify, you talked about a 75% increase in palm oil reporting. Is that an increase in reporting or reporting progress? Or can you just clarify exactly what you meant by that?
It's reporting on progress, correct. Yep.
So a 75% increase in the reporting and progress is what you're trying to make the point. Yeah. Okay, well, thanks very much. Okay, Isabella, I think, Isabella, you're back on the line. Isabella, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Excellent. Right, well, let's go back to where we were. You just started talking about scaling up around beef. And if you could just, as briefly as you can for the remaining points. So I'm conscious we're now halfway through. So thank you, Isabella. Back to you.
Okay, apologies for the piecemeal sort of talk here. So basically, what I was saying about capital intensification is that it makes business sense. It is happening. We need to make sure that we speed that process up and that we put some safeguards in place to ensure that it's not leading to more deforestation instead of less deforestation. So a few ways of doing that is basically ensuring that beef intensification is part of the supplier engagement programs that companies have, embedding it into public policies, particularly around credit, increasing the amount of technical assistance available, and looking into smallholders to make sure that not all of them will be able to intensify because some will not have viable areas to do so. And if they don't, they need to be supported to diversify, because otherwise we will continue to have deforestation, just a different type of deforestation. And then on the safeguard side, we need to make sure that those are built into the credit that is provided for this process, because it does require investment upfront. or the projects that support producers also have some safeguards about making sure that it's a quid pro quo, right? You get the assistance to intensify, you earn more money from it, but your contribution as a producer to this is a commitment not to deforest any further. And also remove the incentives to continue to deforest and move on. One colleague that worked long years in the soy sector and now works in the beef sector is always saying that if you solve cattle, then soy is sorted. Because the idea is that by intensifying the cattle production, you release so much land that you can increase soy production as much as we need, and there'll still be land left to reforest and do other things with it. But that is true. That's absolutely true. But it won't happen by itself, because we know that what makes sense in the macro level doesn't necessarily make sense for individuals making decisions on the ground. And for those decisions to align with this overall goal, we need to engage China on this, because there's still a lot of scope for leakage. So if someone is trying to implement a policy, either be a moratorium in the Amazon, like the one that we have at hand, or new policies in other regions of the country, like the Cerrado, the producer, well, as long as they have options to sell elsewhere and China is not necessarily interested, it's going to be a challenge to make all of these things actually have the impact that we want. And then we also need to align the public policy and the market requirements. So it's no good just to have companies saying that they don't want to buy soy that is linked to deforestation. The public policies need to be pointing in the same direction. And I think there is a good example in the sugarcane sector. There was a lot of self-regulation that happened in the sugarcane sector when they realized that, first, the area that they have is the most suitable, and that they have space to expand without having to deforest. Once the industry realized that, they realized that that can be a selling point for their product abroad as well. So they completely turned the logic, and now, I mean, there are propositions in the Congress to allow for sugarcane to be planted in the Amazon, and the industry is the first one to flag, saying that we don't want this, because they know that it's about the reputation of the sector worldwide. And I think the soy sector can learn a lot from that experience in the sugarcane sector in Brazil. And I'll stop here.
Thanks, Isabella. Thank you very much indeed. Marco, perhaps I can turn back to you. I wondered, what do you perceive, or what have you taken from the panelists' comments? And also, perhaps, we've not covered all the agenda points in the 10. Do you have any thoughts around smallholder yields, which is the point 4 of your agenda, point 8, deforestation commodities, demand in emerging markets, and also point 9, looking at finance? Marco, what are your thoughts at this stage?
Thank you, Ian. Well, Isabella touched just now on the role of emerging market demands in forest risk commodities, and this is the one that we have as point 8, and then the need to mobilize participation in the movement and the demand for deforestation-free commodities from emerging markets. When you actually look at where the demand is coming from for many of these traded commodities now, the role of OECD companies, which make the bulk of the commitments that Stephen and his organization track, is actually limited and shrinking. Much of the growth in demand is now happening in emerging markets as well. And actually, a lot of it also is domestic demand from tropical forest countries. And a lot of it is coming out of Asia. And that is, on one hand, a good sign. I mean, it's generally, this is caused by economic development and rising living standards. But we do need these players to also engage and be brought into this debate. And I think there's good progress that is starting to happen, but nowhere near what we need.
If you look at paper and pulp, for example, most of the new demand for paper and pulp is coming out of Asia. A lot of it out of China and other Asian economies. The same is true for soy. A lot of international soy demand, now China is the biggest importer of soy, is probably going to become the biggest importer of beef quite soon. And India is the largest importer of palm oil. So if we don't actually engage these sources of demand in this movement for deforestation-free commodities, we face the risk of just having a bifurcation of markets where certified deforestation-free products, whether they are paper and pulp certified under forest certification standards or palm oil certified under palm oil certification standards, end up in places that ask for certification, and they end up being produced in places that have already been cleared. But the new production can continue to go into the forest frontier because it's going to supply demands, the markets that don't actually demand that the products are deforestation free. So that's a very critical area where I think that, to be honest, we don't spend enough time and we don't give it enough attention right now. There's some interesting work that has started. And if you read the report, there's some good references on who's actually starting to do this work. But we definitely need to have this much more front and center. I mean, to some extent, this was a discussion that for a while was just a discussion that was happening in Europe and North America. Now I think we have really engaged very well with tropical forest countries. Brazil has done an incredible amount of work, really driven by the domestic action. I mean, having really a domestic movement on this, and I think can be seen as actually an example of what can happen when really the country itself becomes the real driver. But when you are in, you know, I'm in New York for Climate Week right now, when we're having this meeting discussing at the issue of deforestation, you still don't have enough participants that come from the big emerging market demand sinks. We now have participants from tropical forest countries very engaged, so that's actually a big improvement over the past, but we definitely do not have enough participants from those and enough engagement from those emerging markets, and we need to do a better job to bring those markets into the fold of this movement. Sustainably increasing smallholder yields, this is a critical piece of the solution, especially in palm oil and cocoa, where smallholder production is really, really big in cocoa. That's pretty much all of it. And it's a very important component in palm oil. And yields are not there. They lag. Smallholders are finding hard to get access to credit. They find it hard to get access to technical assistance, good genetic materials, and so on. And so their yields are lower, which means that their incomes are lower for the same amount of work that they put into cultivation. And also that if they want to grow, they need more land. And so this is actually a very important area. It's parallel to what Isabella was describing around cattle intensification, sustainable intensification, growing yields so that we use less land for the same production. The agronomics alone are not going to do it, and especially they're not going to stop deforestation, because clearly just growing the yield itself doesn't have automatically the consequence that people want the forest. It's going to make agriculture more profitable up to a point, and then they might actually just decide to expand and encroach into the forest. But in combination with protection and law enforcement, in combination with alternative livelihoods, and in combination with really a sense of ownership of a better future and a better development pathway that doesn't involve deforestation, this can actually be a very powerful thing. And I think in the palm oil sector, we're starting to see a much more understanding of the negative consequences of deforestation for health and air quality pollution, for the loss of habitats, the loss of water services. And so this case is becoming a not just an international case. It's not just about the carbon going up in the air. It's about what's actually also happening to the people who are actually sitting close to the deforestation. So I think if we can actually unlock the power of sustainable intensification, we can actually make a really positive case for an alternative development pathway. And this moves us to finance. This is point nine. Today, there's lots of finance available for agriculture, but not very much actually targeted to sustainable agriculture. Sustainable agriculture is obviously different. It's not necessarily more expensive, but it's sometimes less better known or doesn't have the same level of understanding by market players that the traditional way has. And so it carries an unfamiliarity premium in terms of returns, and we're not seeing enough finance flowing there. We need more public finance. We need more impact finance to de-risk the really new stuff. But we also need the traditional commercial financial players to ramp up their efforts. And then we've seen some universal banks and investment banks introducing zero deforestation policies in their operations. We probably need to see more of those. That's the sector that has been lagging and needs to step up in terms of their commitments and their implementation of commitments. Interestingly, there was the first case of actually a bank acting on its zero deforestation commitments, and early this year that was quite prominent. I think you have talked about this on Innovation Forum. It's encouraging, and it's an important piece of the agenda, because we will need hundreds of millions of dollars of investment in sustainable intensification, in smallholder productivity, in forest restoration, in all these activities that gives us a regenerative agriculture model in order to meet the goals of the sustainable development goals. So this is not just about the stopping of deforestation, but it's the positive agenda of how do you create sustainable regenerative agriculture models that support livelihoods, that create prosperity, but don't do this at the expenses of our global commons of water and air and forest and so on. And the sooner we get on this path, the sooner we'll actually get on the other side. And it's really a change of direction, right? It's not about, I read a quote today that was, when you're going the wrong way, slowing down doesn't help. And so here, if you're investing in the wrong things, investing less in the wrong things doesn't help. We have to actually move the funds away from the wrong things and put in the right things. And so that's why we need these policies in the financial sector.
Great. Now, thank you very much, Barco. What I'd like to do is just very quickly now, in the interest of time, move into getting some of the questions from our audience to our panel. And I'll just ask one panelist to answer each question so we can get through as many as we can. Marco, I want to go to you first of all. Something that's come up many times from our audience is looking at the rising use of tools on the ground, and also using remote sensing and satellite tools to really monitor how things are changing. Was satellite and satellite use and that sort of tool discussed in your creation of your 10 points? And you know, how much do you see this being a solution to dealing with all of the points on your list in the future, Marco?
So yeah, this would fall under our point 10, improving the quality and availability of deforestation and supply chain data. It clearly, this is one of the areas where there has been a lot of progress. 10 years ago, we didn't really know how much deforestation was happening. We knew it at the global level from the forest resource assessment, which was based on self-reporting from countries. Some of the self-reporting was good. Brazil, again, was a pioneer in this area with the satellite system. So you knew it in Brazil, but you didn't really know it anywhere else. And now with Global Forest Watch, we know quite precisely where forest cover loss is happening, which is not always deforestation. We're starting to know also where forest is regrowing. But the translation of these tools into something that is operational and operational use is beginning to happen, but nowhere near at the speed that we need. So I see a strong need for, on one hand, strengthening, making better, more easily accessible these global public good databases of environmental change, environmental status and environmental change. So deforestation, forest area, where the high forest, high carbon value, high conservation value forest is, all this kind of stuff, where is the forest biomass, where the peat is, and so on. So there's a lot of work that can be done there in creating these databases and making them available and really usable. And then in connecting them to the, so this is the biophysical data, and connecting them to the economic and legal data. So where are the concessions? Who's actually in charge of that piece of land? Is there a conflict because there are overlapping claims to it? Is there not a conflict? So if I'm actually a buyer, can I actually understand if my supplier is telling me from which mills the stuff is coming from, or from which slaughterhouse, and from which or from which aggregator, can I get a sense of what is the risk that is embedded there? Am I buying from a place that where I'm actually seeing a lot of deforestation, where I see actually a lot of risk of deforestation? And there's been some interesting work being done under Global Forest Watch on predicting deforestation, or predicting where the deforestation risk is. And so can I then choose to engage and prioritize which suppliers to engage with in my policy, because I know that those are the ones that actually have a lot of risk. And that doesn't mean excluding them. I think we have to be careful, because what has happened, and let me just, this goes back to point eight on finance, on point nine on finance. There is a risk that some players that will take this push as a reason to get out of some commodity supply chains. And why you might think that this is good, there is a risk when the most progressive players, the ones who have most attention to the externalities and the consequences of their procurement policies, disengage completely supply chain and move out and leave it to the ones who basically don't care or don't care as much. And the risk is that the people who are trying to do things right then have nobody who's actually willing to work with them. And everything then goes to the volume and price, and whoever can gets the most stuff at the lowest cost, no matter what the consequences are, becomes the winner in the producer's side. So,
okay, no,
I think we have to, yeah.
Sorry, thanks, Mark. If in interest of time, if we could just draw that to a close there. I'd like to turn to something else that's come up many times from our audience, is looking at jurisdictional approach. Stephen Donofrio, perhaps you can answer this. And in particular, given how new jurisdictional approaches are, what are the measures that you are seeing that can tell us how they are on track? Stephen.
Yeah, we're actually not necessarily tracking jurisdictional programs, Ian. So I'm not sure if I can really speak to that one and give you progress or a status update on jurisdictional programs.
Okay, well, Isabella, is that something you can answer? How are you, the advice of the jurisdictional approach and the success of them so far?
Hi. I think that there are a few initiatives trying to answer exactly that question, to come up with the indicators that jurisdictional approaches can be measured against. The IDH is leading one, the Earth Innovation Institute is also looking into that. I think they already have prototypes out there. But the actual indicators are still, I would say, in a beta version, still up for discussion. But the idea that, yes, we need to be able to know exactly how, because there are different levels of engagement, planning, and actually starting to deliver on their ambitions.
Thank you very much. Okay, Stephen, turning back to you, I do have a question I'm sure you can answer. And it's around something that has come up in from Isabella earlier and also from our audience, is looking at incentives to deforestation. What are you seeing in your research that companies are doing to remove the incentives for deforestation in their supply chain? Stephen?
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously very important, right? I mean, if we're we're speaking about how an entire supply chain or value chain can engage with each other and set common commitments and goals so that there's consistency in an approach, and also creating that thread, threading that needle throughout the supply chain, so we can all get on board with particular strategy. And so we see a lot of companies reporting around engaging with smallholders or working throughout various issues with capacity building, and even we do see things developing, like including references to sustainable development goals in their commitments. So while we're not necessarily tracking this broadly and across the board, we are seeing this integration of other sort of common global goals into these deforestation commitments. Companies are establishing procurement policies and requiring that of their suppliers. Now, obviously, there's the really sort of strong requirements and commitments from companies that sort of at the top of the heap and have been working on this for many years and have maybe more purchasing authority than others. But as this will continue to progress and the understanding of the business risk and potentially the risk of inaction despite having a commitment becomes more apparent by stakeholders, then we'll see more of that we'll likely see more of that from companies actually requiring certain actions of their suppliers. Otherwise, we'll be at risk of losing their purchase order, policy or purchase orders with that end customer company. We've obviously seen examples that are fairly detrimental to companies if they lose their certification within certain, whether it's palm oil or they lose their certification of a commodity, that does have impacts on the business and they can be turned around. But it's a very, very challenging concept for companies at the end of the value chain to do all this without having systems in place that will develop traceability. So traceability is a very important aspect for those policies really to be implemented, not necessarily established, but implemented throughout the value chain. The companies need to know exactly who the actors are. So those are the types of things that we try to look at to see as indicators of companies' abilities to implement their commitments.
Great, thanks very much, Stephen. Perhaps we can move very quickly from incentives to risks. We've had several questions asking and it's turning back to you, Marco, where do you see the biggest drivers of deforestation now? Is it palm oil? Is it soy? Is it beef? Is it pulp and paper, timber? How are the relative risks and drivers changing? Marco?
Yeah, on the... So there is some analysis in the introductory work here that shows that the beef is by far the largest driver of deforestation. Soy, palm oil, paper and pulp doesn't come up as high, but timber is. But we have actually not looked at timber because our mandate is really tied to treated agricultural commodities that are and fiber that are used by consumer companies. Timber is a bit of a different market. Also, timber often is a driver of forest degradation and opens then the road to deforestation, but it's not real kind of final conversion. But I would say that definitely the ones that we discussed are the biggest ones. That's why we focused on beef, on soy, on palm oil, and on paper and pulp. We started to look at cocoa. Cocoa is not on a global scale, is not a huge driver of deforestation, but in certain countries and regions can be extremely important. And some that we have not included in this discussion, but are also important, are rubber, sugar cane. So these are not exclusive as commodities, but in terms of the total amount, definitely these are the biggest ones.
Okay, thanks very much indeed, Marco. We now have to draw things to a close relatively soon, and I'd like our panelists to be thinking about some positive messages to finish with. And in particular, I'd like them each to think about something that companies are, you know, one single thing that companies are doing well to really address and accelerate towards removing deforestation from their supply chains. Isabella, perhaps we can turn back to you. Something that one thing that you think companies are doing well, just as a kind of concluding remark, Isabella.
I think we've seen a wave of commitments which are really promising. And for some time, companies were completely at a loss at how to actually implement them. And my positive look on this is that we're starting to see the companies actually implementing it. And I'm not so worried about the 2020 deadline. It's important to have it. But the things that we started doing right now in terms of engaging suppliers, sometimes getting people to think about deforestation and commit to stopping deforesting, that had never thought that this could be part of a commercial discussion with the company. This is starting to happen. I think there are more companies that need to move on from commitments to implementation, because once you actually start doing it, you realize the things that, you know, DFA was created for. There are so many challenges out there that no single company can tackle by themselves. But they only realize it, and they're only able to identify and engage with others if they start implementing these commitments within their supply chains. So I think we're getting to a point where the companies are starting to be mature enough to engage in multi-stakeholder processes locally, because they know where they're sourcing from, starting to know, and they understand what the risks are.
That's a great point. Stephen, do you want to pick up that? What are you seeing in your research around companies moving from commitment to implementation? Is one thing perhaps that you're seeing them doing best and that's most positive?
Well, I think you're, you know, just going back to the fundamental core of what supply chain is in terms of tracking company reporting and progress that's being reported. You know, just the most encouraging thing that we saw coming out of, you know, our analysis when we did our 2017 report, which we launched earlier this year, was that increase of companies being transparent about where they are on achieving their commitments. And that's really important both for companies that are on track, but also companies that are not on track to meeting those commitments. And there's, with that comes a greater understanding of the types of commitments that are, that have a very easy nature to them of being able to report and update, versus the type of commitments that that are difficult to report updates on, and that will allow us to be more collective as a community of actors to be able to say, yes, this is how to report progress on these types of commitments, and this is how other companies are doing it. So the more we can try to bring all that together and increase the visibility of that, you know, I think we'll help to improve the way companies can report that information.
Thanks very much, Stephen. And Marco, turning to you finally, then, what are you seeing? You know, perhaps one thing is, as I've asked for, one thing that you're seeing that companies are doing well now, and perhaps throwing it forward to the 2030 deadline that you mentioned in your opening remarks.
Yeah, so first let me say that we shouldn't move the deadline to 2030. Let me be very clear. I think the 2030 is the Sustainable Development Goals deadline, but on the deforestation, the deadline is we have this 2020 deadline. We might not meet it fully, but let's not punt it off by 10 years. So I want to be very clear about that. What I think they're doing is that the level of engagement, the quality of the engagement has gone up, right? So we've seen the wave of signing up to these commitments, as Isabella was saying, and now this is becoming real. There's a lot of partnership. There's a lot of companies that are creating good progressive partnerships. Some of them are doing it in platforms like ours. Some of them are doing it with one or two NGOs, local community organization, to push this thing forward. Some are doing both. And I think this is quite good that they're actually trying to do this in collaboration, because collaboration is going to be key for this to actually happen. And one thing that I just want to stress is that the goal, if we take the New York Declaration on Forests, so, you know, we often as the FA 2020 look at the, because one of our funding members is the Consumer Goods Forum, we look at the Consumer Goods Forum commitment, which is a commitment the company made to ending deforestation in supply chains. But the New York Declaration on Forests, their goal to commitment is the commitment to help companies achieve this. And so it commits also the NGO sector. So, and the civil society organization and the indigenous people organization have actually signed up to the New York Declaration and commits the governments to sign up to the New York Declaration. This is a public-private collaboration problem. It's not one that companies can solve alone. They can solve a chunk of it. They can solve some of the things they have it under their direct span of control, but there's a lot of problems that are not under the direct span of control. That doesn't mean that they should just be passing the buck to the other stakeholders. Obviously, they have huge responsibilities, but we cannot make companies, for example, be in charge of law enforcement. We cannot make companies be fully in charge of how rural development should happen. These are functions of government and civil society. In a democratic society, those really are the ones who should be driving that and should set the boundary conditions for corporates to operate and business to operate. So we want business to actually not be just focused on bottom line and also be focused on impact that they have. And I think that's a very good development. But we got to remember that in the end, big decisions about how a community, a province, a nation is going to develop have to be taken through democratic process. They cannot be taken in corporate boardrooms. They have to be taken through the proper channels. And so we need, at the end of the day, the changes to ending deforestation is a change of development, rural development pathway, and that has to be taken in the dialogue between civil society and government with participation of business, but it's not the business responsibility to make those big decisions.
Okay, Marco, thank you very much indeed. I'm going to have to stop the discussion now as we are running out of time. I think in retrospect, we could have focused on any one of the report's top 10 points and talked for them about for an hour. But I would like to thank our panel very much for their time and insight. Once again, if you'd like to continue debating how business can deal with deforestation, then we will be joining. Please do join us in Jakarta next month or in London in November. We will send you a recording of this webinar so that you can listen again at your leisure and share with your colleagues. And we always welcome feedback, so please don't hesitate to contact any of us at Innovation Forum with any follow-up questions and comments. Apologies for the technical problems we had earlier. Sometimes these things happen, I'm afraid. But for now, I hope you found the past hour interesting, and thank you very much indeed for listening.